You're not sick, Amelia, no.
No?
No, you're a little farsighted.
This is the Farsighted Network.
This is the Farsighted Network.
This is the Farsighted Network.
Thanks for listening.
Enjoy the show.
Yeah. It's your man Qualified. And we in the building. Y'all already know what it is. Y'all about to tune into the hottest podcast around. Listen. Yeah. Balls count anywhere, homie, it's no holes barred. Mark out for film spots, cause I'm that hardcore. Ready to rumble, I'm Jimmy King. You want more? John Cena as a Marine, that's what I'm here for. Mandalorian steez, when I'm back on Coscarese. Kevin Nash was super shredder, and he brought them to their knees. If I match your first blood, then Kang will make them bleed. See no evil hit theaters on May 19. Pop from the crowd, use your finisher in the scene. I'm only watching movies if there's a wrestler on the screen. Bought 3 tickets to the Scorpion King and watched Mickey Rourke shining in the wrestling ring. Yeah, we out first, the curtain jerkers. 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 Yes, sir.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Curtain Jerkers. Like most episodes, we're going to be talking about something I know nothing about. So Doug, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. It's been a busy last month. We're recording this very close to Halloween.
Right.
And that's mostly because of my scheduling. I'm in the midst
Usually
of...
it's my fault, so it's okay.
I'm in the midst of midterms. I don't know if I've ever mentioned it on this podcast, certainly on my podcast over at Cinema Smorgasbord, that I'm in school for cybersecurity, and I'm in the midst of midterms right now, and they are kicking the shit out of me. I mean, I'm doing fine, but it's a lot of work.
Prepping,
so
yeah,
if I sound that. Tired, that's why.
Fair enough. I'm tired because I'm always tired.
Yeah, there's that too.
And I had a scalp cyst this week that popped, and it was viciously painful. Actually,
that sounds awful. I bet it was. I mean, those ones on the skull.
Yeah.
And the good thing is, you can't get away from it. You're gonna. It's hard not to touch that when it's right there.
Yeah, yeah. So I was planning on going to the doctor tomorrow, and my wife looked at the hole in my head and was like, "Nah, we're gonna go over to urgent care today."
Okay.
Like, okay. So I'm feeling a little bit better now. I'm on whatever drugs they gave me, but life has been crazy. I live in America. So, the United States of America, to be specific, not just America, because America is all of us. But I live in this country that's going through literal shit right now. And that's always on my mind. So, without getting into all of that, life is
without
fucking
pointing fingers.
Yeah, life is fucking weird. And actually, one of the things I always do in the intro is talk about the general state of wrestling. For me, you said you haven't had time to watch wrestling.
I missed the last AEW pay-per-view, the first time I've ever missed one, because I had to study during that time period. And I mean, it sounded like a great show. Lots of great matches on it. I missed the Eddie Kingston's first pay-per-view match after return, even though I'm still a little confused about why that happened like that. But I mean, it's just sometimes you just get too busy. And also there's just so much of it that it feels like it's like, all right, it's like a moving train, right? You're just going to have to catch it, one of the later parts of the train as it rolls by.
Yeah. Well, so for me,
cars,
I've always had this
train cars.
I've always had explained that I have this this is weird. I love the theatricality and ridiculousness of WWE, but I've had a hard time with the political connections that exist right now in this company.
What are you talking about? What kind of political connections?
One of the guys who's literally in the Oval Office every fucking week. But that has turned me off from being. I can't watch. I literally. It's upsetting to watch WWE for me, and it's a bummer because I really like some of the characters. And
you
some of the
catch
stuff
up with
doing.
It once they have the Saudi Arabian WrestleMania.
Oh my god, god damn it! Yeah, so unfortunately, even though their politics are significantly different, not that everybody's perfect or anything, over at AEW and a lot of the others, the tainting of wrestling has made it hard to watch like current wrestling for me. Like I'm struggling with
it. I think at times like this, you should move away from the United States and look international. No, I just mean it's not, like you said, there's not going to be any perfect.
Yeah.
The fact is a lot of the people in this business are scummy. We said it's a tainted business. We've said it many times.
Oh, without doubt. Yeah.
But it's also, at least you can find solace in different styles, in different cultures. You can learn more about the world that way. And I mean, you still get exposure to people. One of the nice things about AEW is that it takes a global view of pro wrestling, right?
Yeah.
More so than, I mean, frankly, you never would have had that WWE AAA purchase if AEW wasn't also trying to reach out that way.
Exactly.
But also, there's more of a connection to wrestling history in AEW because they acknowledge it a bit more. So it's more fun. You can just say, you know what? I'm going to be focusing on Dragon Gate. I'm going to be focusing on even All Japan, which, I mean, you know, for $6 a month, American, I think, you can get, you know, like 6 shows a month from All Japan. All Japan has lots of great young talent in it. It's got, you know, it's basically just a Japanese indie at this point, not like its heyday.
Yeah.
But you can just focus on smaller promotions.
Well, and I have been watching, you know, some independent wrestling because one thing I wanted to highlight, there were two great, since last time we talked, two really great Jeff Cannonball benefits. The big one here in, you know, Jersey, and then the one up in Canada, Cannonball, that Roch, our friend of the pod, did. And they both seem to raise a lot of money, a lot of awareness for what Jeff's going through. You know, down in Jersey, we got Tara came out of retirement to wrestle, you know, his wife.
I've been keeping up on Instagram, the horror movies that Jeff has been watching this
month. Yes, it's fun. It's fun. And I don't agree with everything he has to say, but, you know, but I like some real shit. I'm going to be honest. I like some real shit. Oh, wait, I mean, I'm talking to the king of shit over here, I know, but
the king of shit, boy. Yeah, I don't know
you
I'll
are
take the that.
You are king shit, my friend. You are king shit. Anybody who doesn't know, Doug has a older podcast that, you know, I don't think you had an episode in several months now.
It's been a while.
But once or twice a year, he comes out with a new episode of No Budget Nightmares, and it's about literal like no and micro like super duper low budget horror films. And man, you guys have covered some of the worst movies that have ever been made, and I loved listening to your pod to know what I should not watch. Sometimes
it's amusing to think back to what we have covered on it, and not to belabor the point. But it's like one of the reasons that I think that both Mo and I kind of lost a little bit of our passion with it was that it, like, once Riff Track start covering like Things and Polonia Brothers movies and stuff like that, it just feels like it's a little too mainstream for
us.
Yeah,
no, I get that.
We love the DIY aspect of it, and we liked, you know, all the connections that we made to the filmmakers through it as well. I just liked our, again, this feels like the ancient complaint of when things get too mainstream. But honestly, some of this stuff doesn't need a big bright light shine on it.
No. I mean, what's the one, is it called Nightmare Museum or something museum where it's literally like Barbie dolls?
So that, I mean, we made a list, I think, a while back. This is might be several years at this point, of the worst films that we ever covered on No Budget.
That had to be the worst, right?
It was definitely one of, I think it was in the top three. Like we both put it in our top three. It's an intolerable movie.
So it's, what's really funny is that the original DVD of that movie was distributed by MVD, who's local to me. And at the time that I got into your podcast, I was very friendly with the head of their warehouse and publicity. So I called him and was like, "Hey, you have any copies of this?" And he's like, "If I do, you can totally fucking have one." And then he looked at me, he's like, "Nah, I don't." So, because he was like, "Yeah, that's one of the worst fucking movies ever made."
For those who don't listen, you might have heard Justin's description and be like, Barbie doll is a movie. I mean, some of the great movies like Todd Field's Karen Carpenter Superstar movie, that's done with Barbie dolls. Maybe it's something like that. It is literally just Barbie dolls with porno noises played over it. There's almost no narrative to speak of. It was...
Yeah, it's Barbie doll fucking, to be specific.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly, right? And it's... I mean, between that and some of the Beelzebub movies that we covered,
oh, God,
like Beelzebub. Jesus Christ... I don't even know if we can say the rest of it here.
Serial. What do people call it in social media? Grapist.
Yeah, grapist. Yeah. Stuff like that. I mean, those were some of the rougher movies that we covered on No Budget Nightmares.
I unfortunately didn't take your advice and did watch that one. I watched it on like 3x speed. But
I think
we
only covered two Bill Zabel movies. The other one was Ant Farm Dickhole, which is one of our You know, here's the thing, listeners, because especially if you're the kind of person to wander like onto Tubi and stuff like this to look at low budget movies, you can get sucked in by those titles, right? And we try, you know, we preached it on the show, don't get sucked in by the title, but it happens sometimes. And I mean, Beelzebub is the classic title guy over quality, and he's a filmmaker, makes low budget movies. I have one here, I have a copy of it called Dick Shark that he made as well.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm not going to watch it. I just want to have it.
Beelzebub movies, I think, fit often in that character. Category. I want to own it, but I'm never going to watch it.
Well, Jesus Christ, Serial Grapist.
Yeah.
It ends with, like, I think I remember, again, listeners, I know that we're belaboring this, but it's like a half hour of just like still images. I mean, when we covered on No Budget Nightmares, you could hear us. Our brains were just like frying. We were just like, it's not even a movie anymore.
So let me ask you about some better movies. As we move into, I've been trying to like occasionally move into like, kind of like a topic, and I want to be quick with this one because I want to like get right into the movies. But it's spooky season, and I want two things from you, Doug. I want you to give me an all time or a couple all time horror movies that involve wrestlers or wrestling for you, and just one or two of your faves in general.
You know, it's funny that we're dipping into Lucha Libre movies today, oddly for the first time, considering its history, right?
Right, right.
And I think maybe there are a few that might fit the bill that would fit into my favorites. The thing about them is that they do tend to blend together. And I think even from watching this one today, which I imagine is one of your first experiences with Lucha Libre movies.
It's up there, yeah.
That you could see how they would all just kind of blend. Even this one feels like it's, you know, I think some of the writing about those movies compare them to old movie serials as opposed to, because it's just like they link together, like El Santo shows up in this one for, it's basically he's like the Deus Ex Machina, right? He just shows up at the end just to fix everything with his flame guns. We'll get into it in just a moment.
With his flame guns, yeah. With his flame guns. Because, you know, that's just what happens.
I'm sort of spinning my wheels. I'm trying to think of any good
horror movies with this. I'll hop in for a second while you're figuring that out. And, of course, my number one is They Live. But we've covered that.
People with wrestling
in general,
stars.
Just wrestlers, or about wrestling. Either way. But one that doesn't actually have wrestlers in it, but is about wrestling. I mean, they might have be people that have been involved in wrestling, but when I asked the director, he was like, no, none of them are actual wrestlers. Is Daniel Armstrong from Australia, movie called From Parts Unknown, Fight Like a Girl. Right. I really like this movie. It's super low budget as well. His first movie was literally about a roller derby team. That's why I got into it, because my wife plays roller derby and I got a copy of it. And then this was his follow up to that. And it's really fun. The guy's made his name mostly as like he does music videos out there and like a lot of rock and rap stuff. But he's done a couple really fun movies. And I would recommend, if you like a low budget zombie movie with a bunch of badass ladies just shooting guns and kicking ass, it's called From Parts Unknown, Fight Like a Girl. So that would be my recommendation for a wrestling related.
Well, since you brought that up, then one sprung to mind immediately, which, and in fact, it also ties into No Budget Nightmares because we covered all three movies in this at what was at the time a trilogy, which is the Argentinian series Plaga Zombie, which
has been on my list since you guys talked about it, and I still haven't watched any of them.
This one of the central characters in that trilogy of movies, even though there's a fourth one that takes place in the U.S., is a wrestler. And in fact, as they go through it, you know, he becomes more, he's very kind of like old school and like a leotard type thing, but it definitely plays with wrestling and wrestling moves in it throughout it. And I can't recommend that entire trilogy enough. It's pretty easy to find at this point, but Plaga Zombie by Pablo Perez and Hernan Saez.
Yeah. I think it's even on Tubi, but I specifically, for this spooky season, my wife and I subscribed to Night Flight. We've been toying with it for a while, and we just added it on. And I mean, it's not exclusively a horror service, obviously, but they have a lot of really fun like horror and exploitation stuff, and it has all the Plaga Zombie movies. And I was like, I think it's time for me to watch these.
It's worth. I mean, if anything, especially the first one. I mean, all three of them are good. In fact, I would say that the sequels are better in terms of how the production values are, but, you know, I love the no-budget DIY stuff, and that first one is super violent, super low-budget, super just, like, people getting together and making the movie that they're trying, and, you know, it's super impressive, and they get more impressive, and they're very satisfying all the way through. Just an incredible accomplishment, and also movies that don't necessarily get a ton of attention.
Yeah, fair. And then my other question is, I guess maybe I'll tailor it to is, do you have a favorite horror movie that you like to watch this time of year? That's kind of what I'm getting at with my other question.
I like creepy movies. Yeah. Like, my favorite horror movies when I was growing up are all the same ones that everyone else would have said at that time period, right? It's The Thing, it's Dawn of the Dead, right? It's The Evil Dead. It's those series, it's Reanimator, all those really fun ones, you know, that extended throughout the years to more international fare. But in terms of what I get in the mood for these days, it's like a Mario Bava. Mm. It's like a gothic type movie, like a Hammer type horror film. But, you know, the one that keeps coming back is, to me recently, is the Bob Clark film Dead of Night. I think it's also known as Death Dream, about the...
Oh, God.
I mean, I've talked about it on many podcasts before, and including, I think, devoted episodes to podcasts before.
Yeah.
But it's about this... basically, it's a Monkey's Paw movie about a mother who loses her child in the Vietnam War, and then he comes back. And he comes back changed, forever changed. And it's this amazing allegory about the trauma that people experienced in that war. But it's also this, like, tragic, it's terrifying idea of this person who has changed, who's in your life. And there's this horrible scene with a dog. But honestly, it's such a bummer movie. Like, it makes me want to cry, especially the ending of it. But it's so powerful. And it is one of those movies where it's like it hasn't been over-discussed. So you really feel like when you're watching, it's like, wow, this is a real gem. Bob Clark, great filmmaker, directed Porky's, at the time, the highest grossing Canadian film of all time.
There you go.
Has a lot of ups and downs in his career. But, I mean, he has a few all-time classics, indisputable.
Yeah, no, that's definitely, he definitely does. And you know, with that movie is a bummer. I like it a lot. I mean, I think it's a great movie. I think it might be a movie I like to think about and talk about more than actually watch and experience sometimes, because the experience of watching it just, like, beats me up.
I've had some difficulty with recent movies that are depressing, like Bring Her Back and stuff, like that. Movies that people say they're just like,
I fucking really loved that movie, but like, I also was
just a really harsh to watch. Yeah. I'm just like, I'm in two. And not to reveal too much to listeners, I'm in too much of a fragile mental place right now to be watching movies that are going to be that much of a bummer.
Yeah. No, Bring Her Back's one of the few that I made it through of that caliber, but it imprinted on me for a couple weeks, honestly, that it was really affecting to me. I've been telling my wife, oh, it's one of the best movies of the year, you should watch it. And I'm like, I don't know if you should watch
it. Yeah, right?
Like, especially, you know, as a parent, there's a lot of parent shit in that movie too. That makes it even harder for me. But, that said, my go-to every Halloween, we watch on Halloween night every year is, Trick or Treat.
Right.
Specifically the one that's the 4 film anthology, one. I did recently rewatch the 1986 Trick or Treat with Sammy Kerr, and introduced my son to that, who fucking loved it. So that was good. But no, it's that one. And then when you brought up Death Dream and you're talking about it, it made me think of a movie that is tonally completely different, but has a similar setup. And that's The Guest.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Which I absolutely love, but it's more of a fun movie in a lot of ways.
It's also, it's arguably a horror movie.
It's not really a horror movie, but it takes place around Halloween too, so it makes it.
I love that movie. I think it's terrific.
There's horror elements. We'll go with that. But yeah, those are my recommendations. And hopefully you guys are watching some good spooky stuff this month. Let's talk about some of these luchadors now, specifically
spookiest movie of all.
Right. I'm so bad at pronouncing Spanish, even though I took it.
Watch several matches involving this person.
Mil Mascaras. I don't have any good pronunciation of Spanish. It's funny because I can actually understand a lot of Spanish. I watched big chunk of this movie with the subtitles off by mistake, and then I was like, but I still know everything's going. Well, this movie's not exactly hard to follow.
It's not a lot of dialogue in this one.
Yeah, not a lot, not really hard to follow either. But in general, like, I understand Spanish a lot better than I can speak it. Like, I can't put the words together. I can't roll my R's. I can't. I'm so fucking white.
Well, I'm Canadian, so
right. But you somehow can probably. Yeah,
I took Spanish in university 1 year of it. Yeah. So I should. I can get some of the pronunciation, or at least I can say it with enough confidence that it sounds like I could say it.
But it stands for a thousand masks. This is his wrestling name. He's essentially the man with a thousand masks.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, that is part of the movie, right? Every scene, right. He has a different mask on.
I didn't ever watch. I've only watched two matches of his now, uh-huh. And they're the ones you sent me. And with that in mind, obviously his thing then? Did he wear different masks like all the time?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's definitely part of his whole deal. We'll get into it a little bit. I mean, I don't have a deep history with Mil Máscaras because, for one thing, basically, by the time I was watching wrestling, even in the 80s, he was like a legend, right? I mean, and I wouldn't have heard about him at that point. We are going to talk about one of his matches from the early 90s in just a little bit. And part of the deal with that match is that he was a living legend. The funny thing is, like, he was wrestling just up to a couple of years ago. He's in his 80s, right?
Right, right.
But, I mean, he wrestles, and this is something we'll get into, a style that a legend wrestles and has been doing that since literally the 70s, right?
Yeah, so like it reminds me of I when I listen to podcasts about wrestling sometimes, I'm going blank on his name. He's like the most famous reporter, Sean, the Fightful guy. My God, why can I not think of his name? I haven't listened to podcasts in a while. Thank you, Sean Rothap. And what I was bringing up about him was that he always says about Jeff Jarrett that part of the reason Jeff Jarrett looks good now is that his moveset's been the same since he was in the 80s, and it aged well because it's not a moveset that like you could lose athleticism and not do, like, oh, I'm less athletic but I can still do these moves.
It's funny because Mil Máscaras is sort of the opposite of that, right? I mean, he brought a certain level of athleticism.
Now, right.
That is a simplistic way of saying it. What I mean is that the Lucha Libre style that he was a big part of and was huge in the 1960s and early 70s, in the early 70s, he went to Japan for the first time, and he has been given a lot of credit, and I don't know how deserved it that is or not, for bringing that high-flying style of Lucha Libre to Japan, which, of course, became a lot of what we think of as the Japanese style and the hard-hitting style, there's usually a lucha influence to one extent or another, certainly once you get to things like Tiger Mask in the early 80s or late 70s. And like, he is considered the starting point of a lot of that, especially because he is a larger... It's funny it's funny to say this because we're going to talk about a match where he's against very large...
Right. Soon,
but
huge
man. He was larger than your average luchador. He could be a heavyweight in Japan. So that made him, that gave him a lot more credibility as well.
Yeah. So, I feel like he, as well as Blue Demon and Santo, are as well known as actors as they are wrestlers.
I think that's
or close to.
The funny thing that differentiates those three, even though all three of them are in the movie today, and this is just my understanding, listeners, I don't pretend to be an expert on this whatsoever. It's just from what I've read, is that El Santo was a wrestler first,
right,
and then became an actor. And Blue Demon was a wrestler first and became an actor. And we're eventually going to do a dedicated El Santo episode.
Definitely.
In reality, I didn't realize at the time it would be so good. El Hijo del Santo, the son of El Santo, announced his final matches today. As of the day that we're recording this. By the end of this year, he will have officially entirely retired. And for those who don't know this, and maybe you don't if you're not someone who, especially in the 90s, grew up with a lot of international wrestling, El Hijo del Santo was at one point, I would consider maybe the best wrestler in the entire world. He was absolutely incredible and generally considered a much better wrestler than his father ever was. He just has tons and tons of incredible matches. In my gap where I stopped watching wrestling, I think, I don't know if he got bad or he just got old. People don't really, and also he doesn't work for any of the big companies anymore, so I don't really know how good he was in his later years. But, I mean, at one point he was an amazing wrestler, and even he, El Hijo del Santo, would make for someone we could feature because he started in a few movies as well. Getting back to what I was saying, though, the thing that separates Mil Máscaras with those two others is that Mil Máscaras' gimmick was made for the movies. He was a wrestler, but he was given the gimmick of Mil Máscaras specifically to be a movie star. And that was in like 1960, in the 60s. And by, you know, and so he had that incredible physique, which you can see in the movie.
Yeah, he does have a great physique. He had a great look. Especially for that era, because, you know, like, it's not, you know, what we are looking at body guys now, they look so much different than body guys then, you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. And, but yeah. There's that, something about that luchador body as well, that really huge upper body, right? It's really kind of distinctive. But Mil Máscaras was given the gimmick to be in the movies and, of course, also wrestle at the same time. So his, you know, he was basically a legend within 10 years of starting, which, of course, at this movie, I think, was 72. I think he started in like 62. So 10 years in, he was definitely established as both movie star and wrestling star.
That's cool. Yeah, and I that's why I have you, Doug, to teach me these things. Just literally, you know. I guess, right. I could just Google things too, right? But I mean, needless to say. That's a very brief introduction of Mil Máscaras, but probably as in-depth as we're qualified to give at the moment. But do you have any other experience with him prior to this? I'm assuming a little bit.
A little bit. I know his reputation. I mean, I remember the first time I read about it was in Foley's first book, but his match we're going to talk about in just a little bit. But since then, I mean, one of the things I've always heard, even though I haven't really seen the matches, even though you can see them very easily, is that his big feud in Japan was against Dick Byer, the Destroyer, also a masked gentleman, though kind of a different styled ones. And they had kind of a legendary feud in Japan throughout the 70s. And they feel like they would match up really well. And then, of course, we're going to talk about a match where he teams with his brother, Dos Caras. They were a very popular tag team in the 70s and 80s in Japan. Dos Caras, of course, being the father of Alberto Del Rio, who at one point fought in mixed martial arts as Dos Caras Jr. and wrestled at the same time, in fact. I'll just known as Alberto these days, and a disgusting gentleman.
Yeah, right.
So I had the general knowledge of him as a pro wrestler from all that kind of thing, and I certainly knew his reputation, but of course that was established very much by Foley's book, which was that he had a very big ego. There's also, by the way, I think he's in a Royal Rumble, right, where he eliminates himself, just jumping on, like, because he wouldn't even let someone else take him out of the Royal Rumble.
It's something we'll definitely talk about later, because there's two guys who refuse to sell in one match together, and it's
why
fun.
I chose that match for us to watch, which is not a great match, but it's certainly an interesting one to watch. But we're not here to talk about wrestling matches yet, even though we are going to talk about a movie that has a couple of wrestling matches in it.
Well, yeah, I think about half the movie is wrestling, actually. The Mummies of Guanajuato?
No, say it in its original language.
Las Momias de Guanajuato. Yeah, that. Directed by Federico Curiel, who actually, when looking him up, was pretty freaking prolific.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I think you would have to be making genre films in Mexico at this time period.
Sure.
He directed a lot of those early El Santo movies, even the ones that people might know, like Santo versus the King of Crime. But funny enough, his first movie, Neutron El Enmascarado Negro, I used to have that poster on my wall at an old
apartment. It's a cool-ass poster, dude. That was the first thing that jumped out at me. I was like, this movie, the poster looks so cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. And I mean, he was directing like a Lucha Libre or Lucha Libre adjacent movies well into the 70s until they lost their popularity.
Right, and I think his 70s. first one was in like the late 50s.
Yeah. I mean, he was there basically at the start of the popularity of the genre, particularly with the Santo films.
And he definitely, I mean, he didn't exclusively make lucha movies. He also had like westerns and other like genre film. But one of the things that stood out to me right away watching the movie is like, I actually love the look of the film.
Yeah,
like I think the color's beautiful. I think the shots are really
how lucky
well,
are we
like,
to have been able to look at a Blu-ray rip of this? It's so funny, right? Because I grew up watching when I was getting into Lucha Libre movies in like the early 2000s, and you really just took what you could get, and most of them were like TV broadcast recordings and stuff like that. And the best you could hope for is that it was that it was like almost like a TV recording, like, and it would be 4x3, of course, it wouldn't be widescreen.
Sure.
And we have this in this case. I was so pleased that I could find nice widescreen. The colors are beautiful. I mean, it still looks low budget because it was.
But... Right. I mean, and there's low budget as far as like effects and things for sure. But the actual like the shot composition, the actual it looked really good.
Yeah.
And like that's the first thing that jumped out at me is like, man, this movie from a filmmaking standpoint looks good.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, at this point, you would hope that it would be professionally done, right? With the sheer number of these that they were cranking out. I think, El Santo alone, I think, released like 58 movies.
That's ridiculous. That was
really only like a 20-year span.
Yeah, well, I mean, if he's doing the equivalent of the Eric Roberts method of coming in for a day, saving the day, and you know... Yeah, maybe that's how. Maybe in a way, he's the Eric Roberts of Lucha.
It's funny to talk about Mil Máscaras as having this big ego when in this movie it's basically like step aside, Blue Demon and Mil Máscaras, who are completely ineffective against these mummies. Santo is here to fix everything.
Well, I mean, to be fair, Blue Demon was actually a mummy in the Blue Demon costume for a large portion of the movie. I mean, come on. So the idea of the movie, it's really hard to like spend time describing the plot because the plots basically could be like summarized in a few sentences, right? I mean, it essentially there's these mummies, and the mummies of Guanajuato are actually a thing, like it's a real thing.
Absolutely.
So it's not like they were tying into an actual like a historical place with really cool weird lore that people were into already.
Yeah, I mean, this movie is as much a travelogue as it is.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, without a doubt.
You're getting a sense of like the local culture, the local like geography and things like that. I think that's kind of one of the fun things about it. By the way, this movie, I believe, was the most successful of all Lucha Libre movies.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
And I mean, and so in an early scene when you're seeing the mummies, one of them is way taller than the rest, and he is a luchador named Satan.
Mm-hmm.
And the crazy thing for me, though, is he talks about he's like 7'4 or something like that. Well, the mummy up on the wall is, but the guy playing him is barely taller than Mil. And like that's something that bothered me because I was like, you called him 7'4", dude. Like, can't you pick a wrestler that's taller than this? That was just a weird thing that bothered me, you know. But, you know, needless to say, it wasn't that big a deal. But, yeah, the idea is that these mummies come. Satan gets these other mummies to, like, be his henchmen, and they terrorize the town, and the luchadors have to save the day. And, ultimately, they save the day with El Santo having to do all the actual saving because the other two wrestlers can't do shit, like you said.
I mean, the story of Satan, the wrestler in the movie, ties in with El Santo's, I guess, his father or grandfather.
Right.
The idea is that El Santo was something that gets passed down from generation to generation.
Right.
And this happened in the mid to late 1800s, where this event happened where El Santo's relative beat Satan. He had sold his, soul to the devil or whatever. I mean, anyway, made some promise to the devil. And I guess, 50 years later, 75 years later, it is foretold that he'll come back. And so at the end of the movie, of course, all of this is just being told. We don't see El Santo at this point, but we know that, of course, the devil character is obsessed with him. And of course, eventually, with like 20 minutes to go in the movie, which this movie is ridiculously paced, El Santo shows up in his fancy car with his buddy, and he's like, oh, what? Mummies are attacking everybody. I better get my gun that shoots fire, and that works. It burns them all, and it just saves the day.
Yeah, it's basically like a cross between a blowtorch and a laser gun. I don't even fucking. It's wild and
it's super badass.
Funny.
I love it.
I do love it. And it's like it comes out of nowhere. It's ridiculous, but it's great. It kind of reminds me of like the ridiculousness of and because there are a bunch of movies where weird weapons like that are used in this era, and they could even Quentin Tarantino riffed on that in the freaking. Once upon a time in Hollywood, where he just has a blowtorch and just kills Nazis with a fucking, needless to say, flamethrower, not blowtorch. A blowtorch is like,
not going to kill him, but whatever. You get the point of what I'm trying to say. I like the movie a lot. I don't have a lot more to say about it, but I enjoyed it. Like, I really enjoyed the experience. I could see it being really fun in like a theater with actual, like, a bunch of people. Like, I could see everybody cheering along and having a fun time with it. I could see really enjoying it if I was imbibing certain substances, you know? I mean, it was a good
thing.
One of the
things I like about these luchador movies is that they're oddly self-serious. Like, there isn't any winking, right? It's not campy, even though it kind of resembles, like, a 60s Batman.
There's a lot of Batman vibe to it without being...
And, like, there's inherent comedy, right? Mm-hmm. Just these men walking around with their sweaters and their luchador masks and things like that. But it's never winky. I mean, not the most famous era of movies. And it's basically like we have this superhero, real-life superhero, someone who you could see walking down the street in Mexico, right? And there's lots of people who are like him. They are superheroes. And what do superheroes do? They fight villains. They fight monsters. And that's what they're going to do in these movies. And it's like El Santo fought gangsters and he fought vampires and he fought, you know, mummies and he fought werewolves. I mean, it's just, I just love it's, it is sort of childlike and childish in some ways, but it's also funny because they combine this very athletic style of wrestling. It's funny to watch the wrestling scenes in this movie. It's fascinating, right? I mean, frankly, the one of the incredible things about these movies existing is that it's some of the only contemporary Lucha Libre footage we have of a lot of these wrestlers. You know, it's not like if you want to see Mil Máscaras footage from the 1970s, you got to go to All Japan, right? You got to see those Destroyer matches and stuff like that. There's very, very little footage of El Santo or, I mean, any of those contemporaries like Hurricane Ramirez and Gory Guerrero and all that sort of shit, which is why it makes it difficult for us to do like an episode that's dedicated to those. And why when we are going to talk about matches today, they're matches that are 20 and 30 years into Mil Máscaras' career. But so you have these, you get to see what, to a certain extent, what Lucha Libre looked at like at that time period. And it's, I mean, it is certainly slower paced than the wrestling of today, but you can see the DNA of what we see today with all the, like, the hip tosses and the running the ropes and things like that. It's really interesting.
Yeah. And one of the other things you mentioned that I just wanted to touch on, I absolutely love watching guys in, like, three-piece suits with a lucha mask. Like, so, like, I'm sure you've probably seen a couple years ago film Low Life.
Who are you talking to?
I forgot that Ryan's a friend of mine too. I forgot that he was on your podcast too. He was on mine years ago. Yeah. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Just the story. I saw Low Life as a screener for the Fantasia Film Festival.
Oh, that's cool.
Someone sent it to me, and I think that it was before it had premiered anywhere. I believe I saw it, and I'm like, I need to meet the person who made this movie.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Liam and I went to the Cinepocalypse Festival in Chicago to do our Eric Roberts live interview. And I sent a message to Ryan Prowse, who I knew vaguely through social media. And I was like, I got to meet you. I got to meet the person who made this movie. I think it's incredible. And they were showing that movie at the festival. And I met him and I hung out with him for a while. And we had a really good time. And he was like, nicest guy on earth, met his partner, met all sorts. And I mean, it's so exciting that his next movie is now out, just had a big splash at the Fantastic Fest, and hopefully I can't wait to see it. I mean, he's a gem of a person and an incredible filmmaker, and of course made the all-time best segment from any of the VHS movies too.
And I just know him because he's from Atlanta, and I know a bunch of Atlanta film people because of Blaine and helping with the Buried Alive Film Festival. So I met him at a Buried Alive Film Festival, you know, just hanging out. So but yeah, so that said, I think of that character, and that character is obviously based on kind of like this kind of Santo Lucha thing, because he's literally has this lore to him. But
absolutely, well, I mean, just the idea that someone like that is just walking the streets, right? And I love that there's a reality to that to a certain extent. That, you know, these luchadores who never took off their masks, who would walk in public, you know, El Santo would be seen in public wearing his mask. But of course, they can also, they want to become anonymous, they can just take off the mask and they can walk around anonymously. It's such a beautiful kind of, you know, mild-mannered Clark Kent turning into Superman type situation.
Definitely. So we're going to talk about a couple matches with Mills, besides the ones that comprise about half of the movie. Although he's not in all of those. He's in some of those, but whatever. This first match is from 1983. Where was it, in All Japan?
Yeah, All Japan. I think it was part of their... If it's the end of the year like this, it's almost certainly part of their tag tournament.
Okay.
We talked about that Brody and Hanson.
Right. We've had Brody and Hanson matches before on this show.
Yeah, the very first Brody and Hanson match, I believe.
Yeah, and the two of them are fighting Mills and his brother Dos Caras.
Fighting is a good way of putting it.
Yeah. Wrestling might not necessarily be the case in all of it, but it's if you're not familiar, if you happen to be listening to this podcast and you're not familiar with Brody and Hanson, I'd be surprised. But Bruiser Brody and Stan Hansen are mammoth men. Yeah. Like, these are giant dudes, and they're, especially in their era, they're like they're just huge, huge guys. And while Mills, as you were saying, is not exactly one of the smaller luchadors, he's actually big for a luchador.
He is billed as being 5'11", which means that he's shorter than that, certainly. But it's funny that even at like the exaggerated build height, he's still below six feet. It's funny because, like, I mean, like, Bruiser Brody is 6'3", I think, which is tall, right? I mean, definitely tall.
I mean, that's how tall I am.
Yeah, so, yeah. And I'm tall.
Yeah, you're even taller.
But you can really see. I mean. There's a huge difference between
Mills is probably 5'8", not 5'11". But, you know, but you look at that and, like, man, they just look so much bigger. And, like, their builds, you know, both Bruiser and Stan Hansen are, like, they're just big men. Like, not just tall.
And they're
but, like,
wild men. Like, that's their gimmick, right? It's funny because the dynamic here should be, of course, even though Mil Máscaras and Dos Caras are both legends and established at this point, that they still... You know, even as legends, you got to work from the bottom a little bit, right?
Sure.
I mean, it's like you're facing these two gigantic, wild, crazy guys who barely sell, and then you have to overcome to a certain extent. However, I think at some point, Mil Máscaras got the note that his team was losing, and he was like, well, that's not the dynamic we're going to be playing with today.
Right. Well, so he, you chose this match, I guess, because first off, let me see if I can put these words in your mouth. First off, the All Japan matches are the most available matches of Mills in that era.
Absolutely. I probably should have picked one of his Destroyer matches to show him at his better light. It's kind of a shame that we're kind of going to be knocking him a little bit. But, I mean, he does have a reputation. I mean, he's still with us, right? He's in his 80s.
Yeah.
There is no doubt that he is a legend. And probably, I think it in some ways that Mick Foley is a little unfair in his discussions about him. Because if Mil Máscaras wants to come in as a legend and do his legend match, even though it won't be a great wrestling match, I get that it hurts Foley's ego because Foley wants to have good matches, and I can understand why. But anyway, we'll get to that in just a little bit. I will say that the person coming out of that particular match that comes off well is not Mil Máscaras.
Right. And I'll argue with that match that I actually think Foley looks great in that match.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I mean, he did wrestle a good match. But So anyway, this first match, I mean, ultimately, like, I don't have a ton of notes personally. My notes were basically, like, about their size, the difference, and the fact that, like, both, you know, so you have these big guys who don't sell a lot already, and then you have Mills not selling for them at all.
Yeah.
And that's, it's kind of funny because you don't really, like, it's like they're hitting each other and nobody's affected by it.
Or they'll do a move and someone will just pop right up again, right? I mean, that's what you basically have are two wrestlers who had a reputation of being a little bit difficult, which is Mil Máscaras and Bruiser Brody. Now, Bruiser Brody is one of my all-time favorite wrestlers, but the fact is, you know, he did not suffer fools gladly. He did not put up with disrespect, and also he would not.
And there's how many stories of him actually like getting in knife fights. I mean, this guy is a crazy fucking dude.
But I mean, he knew that he had an image that he had to maintain, and he was going to do whatever he had to do to maintain it. If that meant walking out of a promotion, he knew that he was a free agent who could go to another one. And, you know, and Mil Máscaras, he probably thought of himself in much the same way. And then you have two very professional wrestlers, to a certain extent. I mean, with Dos Caras, who is an incredible pro wrestler, by the way. I remember watching his matches. He was wrestling in the 90s. And he just had this odd comeback. I think he was wrestling Michinoku Pro, but he wrestled New Japan for their junior tournament in the mid-90s and was looking great for a guy his age. And Stan Hansen, of course, who's had great matches in all sorts of decades.
Well, and I'm not saying Stan Hansen didn't sell at all, but he didn't sell much because his character doesn't sell much.
Well, it's the kind of selling where you build up to the sell
right.
a little bit, right?
But like those the only like traditional like wrestling selling I saw was from those characters in the whole match. Like he's the only guy who actually sells.
It's so funny because Mil Máscaras will like tag out and then it'll turn into like a wrestling match for just a little bit, and then Mil Máscaras will come in again, and him and Brody will be like doing rabbit punches at each other, and one will get frustrated at the other not selling, and then the other will get frustrated, and you can see it in the match. It's not like it turns into something unprofessional necessarily, but it doesn't look like, I mean, it's really like choreographed. It looks like people are fighting against each other.
Right. Do you have any specific moments that jumped out at you as things you like that were like your favorite parts?
I mean,
of this
it's
match?
A short match too.
Yeah.
I mean, I just love the pageantry of All Japan. Sure. I know that's an odd way to put it, but I just love the whole, I love that they can kind of waste time a little bit in this era. And I know it's not really wasting time, but what it would be seen as wasting time on television today, which is both teams get their entrances. Both teams get their introduction, right? Everyone gets a little moment at the beginning. It all feels like, all right, we're on an even keel and now we start. And I like that the violence kicks in right away. I mean, it's still a very stiff match. Those guys work really stiff. Brody and Hansen will beat the shit out of guys. That's kind of their deal. But I like that basically Mil Máscaras, once Dos Caras has to take the fall, he's just leaving, right? And also once that match ends, once the bell rings, Brody and Hansen are gone to the back. They don't even hold on for a second. They are gone. It's an interesting match to watch. I'd love to hear like some thoughts on people involved in what exactly occurred during this match.
Yeah, you wonder exactly, you know, what they. Yeah, I mean, so it's interesting. With Mills, Máscaras, you know, I just, of course, I'm just putting this together because I'm a weird guy. But Dos Caras, is his name basically like also about masks?
Yeah,
Caras,
sure,
two masks. Yeah. So we have million masks, we have 1,000 masks and 2 masks.
It's tough being a Legends brother.
right. I only get 2. He's got the other 1,000. So. You said that he was a fantastic wrestler, and he, you know, he is, when he's in the match, it is a match. It is a wrestling match. Are there like classic Dos Caras matches that I should be looking at?
So the Dos Caras matches I watched that were big were like he's in this super, I think the second Super J Cup, the 95 one.
Okay.
He has a match versus El Samurai in that, which is really good. And like I said, that run he was doing in the 90s in Japan, I think are worth going out of your way to see. Okay. I think that the best Dos Caras Mil Máscaras tag match that I've seen is them versus Giant Baba and Jumbo Tsuruta around this same time period. And that's available pretty easily as well.
Okay.
I mean, I think El Canek is his big rival in Mexico, but I've never seen any of those, any of that footage. It's an exciting time to be a fan of Mexican wrestling because new footage is just popping up all the time because there's just like, there isn't a lot of archives, but there are things that people have taped that just have never been digitized. So you see it happening all the time. That said, it doesn't go much further than like back than the mid 80s. And that's right. If you're lucky.
No, and I mean that's pretty cool, and yeah, I'll definitely have to check out his '90s All Japan run. That's interesting to me, the Super J Cup. So I'll definitely check that stuff out because, you know, obviously I always ask what are some other favorite matches from, you know, and I didn't ask because of Brody Hansen because we've already kind of covered them.
Yeah, basically
a few times.
In our most recent episode. I mean, there's lots of good suggestions there, but the fact is, they as a tag team, they were, I mean, comparatively, they were only there together for a few years. So, I mean, you can basically, anything that's available is worth checking out.
Definitely. So then we fast forward a little bit to 1990, and we're in WCW. Clash of the Champions. We have Cactus Jack.
You mean Cactus Jack Manson?
Is that what they call him?
Yeah.
I didn't even realize that. I don't know why I didn't notice that. Cactus Jack Manson. Interesting. I didn't catch that.
I mean, he hated it, right? Because they thought he looked like Charles Manson.
and he kind of does.
Yeah,
he does. He does. And Mills. So we've got the two of them in this match. And this is a match that's known for what you talked about. So talk to me about that. Talk to me why you chose this match and kind of what it's known for.
Well, I mean, like I said, the first thing I ever read about Mil Máscaras was from Cactus Jack, from Mick Foley's first book, I think that one was Have a Nice Day. Was it the first book? I can't remember.
I think so.
And he talked about this match specifically and about how he was disappointed in it, that he had a hard time with Mil Máscaras. He thought he had a big ego. I mean, he does. And in fact, there's a video clip that you can watch online from Foley's podcast while it was still on, where he was talking about this match. And he was like, they weren't sure if Mil Máscaras was going to make it to the Clash of the Champions 10. And so he was set up to have a match with a different wrestler. And I think he was even going to go over. And he was really happy about that because, I mean, I'm sure for his own ego, winning would probably be a lot better than losing to a guy who was only going to be in for like a week or two. Because right. They mentioned on the show that he had done like a worldwide taping and stuff like that. And so I think, like, just generally, I think Foley had a really bad time in this match. And it seemed like the commentators, which are Jim Ross and Jim Cornette on this, they recognized that he was not happy, so they decided that they were going to put him over as hard as they possibly could.
Yeah. And speaking of going over hard as you possibly can, there's a pretty rough spot in this match.
I mean, it's the spot of the match. When you watch this match, there's only one thing you're going to remember. It's Foley right. taking that bump.
Yeah.
Honestly, two things. Foley taking that bump and Foley setting up a chair only to fall over it several seconds later.
All right, so that's hilarious. The chair spot early in the match is one of the funniest things.
This match is 6 minutes long. It's all early in the match.
Well, okay, fair. But, I mean, it's like it's very beginning of the match, basically. Like, it's like, you know, it's first time he goes outside the ring, he sets up this chair and he fucking trips over it.
Yeah, it's great.
It's pretty great. I really enjoyed that moment, and it feels very Foley, just because it's the kind of dumb shit that he'd do every once in a while in a match. Like, and I thought that was funny. but that said, you know, you said that he had a difficult time. He talked about the difficult time he had working with him, and like wanted to have a good match. But I actually think he looked really good in this match.
Oh, he does, and of course, part of that is he is. Bumping hard for Mil Máscaras' stuff. There's a little bit of like, you can see that they're not entirely on the same page at the beginning, which you can imagine. It's not, you know, there's the first time they ever wrestled. There's potentially a significant language barrier, but you know, Foley's making his stuff look good, and it's not like Mil Máscaras is going in there and he can't move, right? He's doing his shit, right? He does yeah. his top rope crossbody, and he does his flying chop, and you know, all of his hip tosses and stuff like that. It's funny because they're doing more than your average match that you would see in WCW. Or, well, I mean, WCW had some good wrestlers at that time, but like, yeah. you know, American wrestling generally, you probably wouldn't think of it as anything that wasn't great. But you can hear the crowd starts to get restless even in like the 5 minute mark of this mm-hmm. match. You can hear a few people chanting boring and stuff like that, and you got to imagine that hurt Foley's pride, because he really does, you know, pride himself on giving the people the show, and his response to that was to take a bump that looked like he literally cracked his skull on the concrete.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of notorious bumps that Foley's taken in his career,
yeah.
right?
More than anybody has notorious
and yet,
bumps.
This is one of the ones, the first ones in a while, and I've watched several matches of his for this pod. I've watched several matches of his just for fun, because I like Foley. And some of them, I've watched some of his, like, compilations of his worst bumps and stuff. Like, this one made me cringe. Like, I was like, I watched him like, shit.
Yeah.
Like, it does look like he's literally going to crack his fucking head open on it.
The spot is set up with him. He's going to do his famous cactus elbow from the apron to the floor, which is already a nasty bump because he has to take all that impact on his hip. But Mil Máscaras gets back in the ring and kicks him off the apron, and he falls straight onto his back on the concrete over the blue mats. And I mean, I don't think he actually hits his head on the concrete, but it certainly is a big, I mean, it's as about as safe a way that you can do that bump as possible. And frankly, there's no safe way to do that.
Right. Right. Just doing it the safest way is still like, you shouldn't, honestly, it's just a bad bump to do. But yeah, it looks so brutal. And that, yes, that is what stuck with me. But like, I guess because I watched an awful lot of Mick Foley in the late 90s. When I watch him in the early 90s, even late 80s, whatever, you know, some of the Japanese stuff we've watched, some of the other stuff, I'm often taken aback by like how well he moves in the ring. Not that he didn't move well, but he, you know, he got thicker. His wasn't really his thing all the time to do, like, sometimes he does some really, like, I just think he moves a lot smoother when he was young.
I mean, what are you really saying here? The less damage that's done to his body, he moves.
Well, I mean, to be fair, also, he obviously wrestled in a career where he beats the living shit out of himself. So, like,
I mean, he was. I mean, at this point in his career, it's not like he was fat. I mean, he was in decent shape, and I mean, he was a good looking guy, especially considering, you know, how deranged he was supposed to be.
Yeah, I mean, he got compared to one of the best looking serial killers of all time, right? Yeah. The side of Ted Bundy, I guess, right? But yeah, I mean, like, it's ultimately, I enjoyed the match. I enjoyed reading up on the history of it and kind of that stuff. I've never read any of Foley's books. I have a copy of Have a Nice Day, and I just haven't watched. I got it at somebody's yard sale for a quarter.
I wonder. I read it when it came out, and I read it at least a couple of times after that. I mean, it's just a really entertaining book,
yeah.
And it made you just like really interested in watching more of his career. And the funny thing now, I mean, compared to when I was reading the book, is you could read that book and watch those pieces piece by piece, right? There's so much of that footage that is easily available, and that I think would be a really fun kind of experiment to do. But Foley he's a very sympathetic character, even though some of the things he says and does, I don't always agree with. By the way, that's not a response to his recent condemnation of ICE, obviously.
His recent shit, we're all on.
Calls Vince McMahon Mr. McMahon and shit, I understand that he helped you make a lot of money, buddy, but he made a lot more fucking money off of you.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and honestly, though, he's a guy who has beaten the crap out of his body and clearly gave his life to this craft. So I'll give him that for sure.
Sure.
And absolutely, you're right. He's definitely a sympathetic in that most, you know, he has questionable things he says or does, but in general, he feels like he's one of the good guys. You know what I mean? Compared to a lot of the other people in this industry.
Look, he was from an era where a wrestler with even the basest conscience was a rare enough thing.
Right.
Which is
right.
Why he really stuck out for having.
Right. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I would ask, you know, what other Foley matches but I feel like we've covered him several times, so I don't know that we have anything new to cover for Foley. But man, I like watching some of these matches that I've never seen before of his, especially for me, like, you know, from WWF in the, you know, mid to late 90s when he was starting to make himself more available with there more, and then he became a full-time guy there. Like, that's where I know him from.
Sure.
So I know a lot of that stuff. So watching him before that is where, like, and despite the fact I watched a lot of NWA WCW in the early 90s, I don't remember a lot of them. Like, what I remember mostly are, like, the things that I could rent at Blockbuster. So like I would rewatch a lot of the things, but Clash of the Champions was always specifically a made for TV. That was kind of their thing. Clash of the Champions was on TV. It was
that's pay-per-view, right. Absolutely.
On TV.
Yeah.
And so like in the early 90s, I wasn't watching those on TV yet, you know? So I don't remember a lot of the stuff from this.
As I've said many times in this podcast, I didn't have access to WCW up until the mid 90s.
Right.
And at that point I was not really watching a lot of wrestling, but I do have a distinct memory of in Newfoundland in like 1993, I think it was, that our local pay-per-view provider, you know, they sometimes do like previews of upcoming pay-per-view stuff. And they had a promo for the Cactus Jack Vader Spin the Wheel Make a Deal match, which at the time I was like, what is this? This looks like the crazy. Who are these guys, right? And of course, I never really got to find out who those guys were for years afterwards. I mean, Vader, you know, made it to the WWE later, and so did Foley. But at that point, I didn't connect it to those kind of things. But I mean, I still think those Foley Cactus Jack matches are definitely worth going out of your way to see.
Yeah.
If you really want to see what Foley can do when a guy who also doesn't do a lot of selling but is working with him, they just beat the living shit out of each other is what they do.
Yeah. So, I mean, that I honestly, I remember those matches quite a bit. And,
sure.
And they're fun. I love Vader. We covered Vader in that really horrible Fist of the North Star movie. So
we sure did.
Yeah.
And I don't think we'll be, unless we're going to watch that Boy Meets World episode.
And I mean, I liked that episode growing up. I remember it well, but I don't see any reason that we need to dive into that for this. But with that in mind, you know, it was a fun thing for me to like check out some Lucha movie. Like, I've never really watched a full movie. Like, I've seen parts of a thousand things with Santo in them, right? But I don't know that I've sat down and watched a whole movie till now.
I mean, this one was a fun example because you had all three of them in right. it. But also, it's such, like, I mentioned the structure, but it is for listeners who have not seen this movie or any of these Lucha Libre movies, particularly of the 70s or the early mid-70s, with the ones that are in color. Like, this movie starts with, like, 10 minutes of driving around.
Yeah.
Right? Then we get the introduction of who the mummies are in their history. That's another 10, 15 minutes. Then, like, we get introduced to Mil Máscaras and Blue Demon in a lengthy wrestling match. We barely get any dialogue.
In fact, the longest wrestling match that we watched for this episode was probably that.
Probably so. So it's like 30, 40 minutes before the characters start to do stuff. And then you get interrupted by a couple of other wrestling matches. And, like, you probably only have, like, 30 minutes of story in this entire 90-minute movie. They're very easy to watch, particularly from the context of if you don't care about a lot of stuff, you can just have it on in the background.
Yeah, yeah. And that's probably the way I will watch more of these kind of movies when I'm not watching them for a podcast, right? So, yeah. I mean, with that in mind, though, Doug, I think it's time to say Happy Halloween and tell everybody where they can find us.
Yeah. I mean, this is hopefully everyone gets to hear this on Halloween or right around.
They will. They will. I'm vowing that this episode is out before Halloween. And that means I only have a couple days, but that's good. I'm doing it. So don't worry, Doug. I mean,
well, so you want me to do my plugs?
Yes, please.
Well, you can always find my other podcast, Cinema Smorgasbord, every single Monday, including that if you are listening to this on Halloween, just a few days from now, you will be able to hear our Halloween special, which is coming out on the Monday after Halloween, just because, like I said, I've been very busy recently, but it's coming, where we're going to be covering two recent horror movies on that and talking about some recent horror movies that we've enjoyed. But that podcast has a bunch of themes that you can enjoy, including podcasts devoted to the career of Carol Kane, George Kennedy, Oliver Reed, Alejandro Jodorowsky, Jackie Chan, Dick Miller, lots of different themed podcasts all over at CinemaSmorgasbord.com every Monday. You can find us on X the Everything app at CinemaSmorg, S-M-O-R-G, CinemaSmorgasbord on Facebook and Blue Sky. You can follow me on Blue Sky. Just search for Doug Tilley. That's T-I-L-L-E-Y.
For the most part, the best way to find me as far as anything I've written or anything I do is either at this website at farsightedblog.com or I do a bunch of back-end stuff, but I have a bunch of writing up on synapse.co. And I'm not super active on my socials all the time. I'm trying to be less active on them, to be honest, because of the world I live in and the country I live in and the people who own those platforms. But you can find me at The Farsighted, the website over at Instagram. And I am personally over at Blue Sky at The Painted Man. .bluesky.social or wherever the hell they call it, right? The Painted Man. And so with that in mind, thank you guys for coming and hanging out with us this month, and we will be back next month with probably something a little more contemporary, I believe. So if you're not interested in the old stuff and you want to watch something newer, hey, we can watch something newer. But we'll see how it goes. Well, Doug, thanks for making some time for me, my man.
Glad to be here. Hope people check out these movies. I mean, we're lucky to be in a time where there's lots of Lucha Libre movies out there to enjoy in decent quality.
Everybody, take care.